and gently raised it and kissed it. Then he got to his feet and turned to Javert. "Now," he said, "I'm all yours." A suitable grave. Javert placed Jean Valjean in the town prison. The arrest of Monsieur Madeleine caused a sensation in Montreuil-sur-Mer, or, more precisely, an extraordinary commotion. We are sad not to be able to conceal the fact that when they heard the words, "He was a galley slave," almost everyone abandoned him. In less than 2 hours, all the good he had done was forgotten, and he was nothing but a galley slave. We should add, in all fairness, that the details of the Arras episode were not yet known. The whole day, conversations like the following could be heard all over town. "Don't you know? He was a convict who'd been freed." "Who was?" "The mayor." "Come on, Monsieur Madeleine." "Yes." "Really?" "His name wasn't Madeleine, it's something awful. Béjean, Beaujean, Boujean. Ah, heavens above, he's been arrested." "Arrested?" "Locked up in the town prison, waiting to be transferred." "To be transferred, to be transferred. Where are they going to transfer him to?" "He's going to appear in the circuit court for some highway robbery he did before." "Well, I did have my suspicions. That man was too good to be true, too perfect, too sickly sweet. He refused the cross. He handed out sous to all the little beggars he met. I always thought there was something bad at the bottom of all that." The drawing rooms, especially, were all frantically touting this view. One old lady, a subscriber to the Drapeau Blanc, made this unfathomably deep observation: "I can't say I'm sorry. That'll teach the Bonapartists." This is how the phantom, once known as Monsieur Madeleine, broke up and evaporated at Montreuil-sur-Mer. 3 or 4 people alone in all the town remained faithful to his memory. The old concierge who had served him was one of them. The evening of the same day, this worthy old woman was sitting in her lodge, still quite bewildered and reflecting sadly. The factory had been shut all day, the carriage entrance was locked, the street was deserted. There were only 2 nuns in the house, Sister Perpetua and Sister Simplice, who were watching over Fantine's body. Round about the time that Monsieur Madeleine normally came home, the good old caretaker automatically rose, took the key to Monsieur Madeleine's room out of a drawer, along with the candlestick he always used to mount the stairs to his room. Then she hung the key from the nail, where he would normally get it, and placed the candlestick to one side as though she were waiting for him. After that she sat down again in her chair and went back to her musings. The poor old woman had done all this in her goodness, without being remotely aware of what she'd done. It was only after a couple of hours that she snapped out of her reverie and cried, "Heavens, Lord Jesus Christ, look at me, hanging his key on his nail!" At that moment the window of the lodge opened, a hand moved through the opening, grabbed the key and the candlestick, and lit the candle by the light of a burning taper. The caretaker lifted her eyes, and her mouth fell open, but she managed to stifle the cry that rose in her throat. She knew that hand, that arm, the sleeve of that coat. It was Monsieur Madeleine. It was a few seconds before she could speak, gripped as she herself later put it when she told her story. "My God, Monsieur le Maire," she cried at last, "I thought you were..." She stopped, for the end of her sentence would have been lacking in respect for the beginning. Jean Valjean was still, for her, Monsieur le Maire. He completed her thought. "In prison," he said, "I was. I broke a bar at the window. I dropped down from a rooftop, and here I am. I'm going up to my room. Go and get Sister Simplice for me. She is no doubt with that poor woman." The old woman rushed to comply. He did not caution her at all, knowing perfectly well that she would protect him better than he could protect himself. No one ever knew how he managed to get into the courtyard without going through the carriage entrance. He had, and still carried on him, a master key that opened a small side door. But he should have been searched and the master key taken from him. This point has never been cleared up. He mounted the stairs that led to his room. When he got to the top, he left his candlestick on the top step, opened his door virtually without a sound, and groped his way to the window, which he then closed along with the shutter. Then he came back for the candle, and went back into the room. It was just as well to take such a precaution. You'll remember that his window could be seen from the street. He ran his eyes around the room, over his table, his chair, his bed, which had not been slept in for 3 days. No trace of the chaos of the night before last remained. The caretaker had made up the room. Only she had picked out of the ashes and placed carefully on the table the 2 ends of the iron-tipped club and the 40-sou coin blackened by the fire. He took a sheet of paper and wrote, "Here are the 2 ends of my iron-tipped club and the 40-sou coin stolen from Petit Gervais, of which I spoke at the circuit court." And he put the silver coin on the piece of paper along with the 2 bits of iron, so that it would be the first thing anyone saw when they entered the room. He took one of his old shirts out of a wardrobe and tore it up. This provided strips of cloth in which he wrapped up the 2 silver candlesticks. He didn't seem to be in any hurry or in any agitation, and while he was wrapping up the bishop's candlesticks, he munched on a lump of black bread. It was most likely the bread they'd given him in prison, and which he'd taken with him when he escaped. This was observed by the breadcrumbs that were found on the tiled floor when the law later ordered a search. 2 soft raps sounded at the door. "Come in," he said. It was Sister Simplice. She was pale. Her eyes were red. The candle she was holding wobbled in her hand. The violent jolts of fate have this peculiar feature, which is that, however perfectly controlled or detached we may be, they drag human nature out of the depths of our entrails and force it to reappear on the surface. In all the emotional upheavals of that day, the nun had become a woman again. She had wept, and she'd been shaken. Jean Valjean had just written a few lines on a piece of paper, which he handed to the nun, saying, "Sister, you will give this to Monsieur le Curé." The note was not folded. She glanced at it. "You may read it," he said. She read, "I beg Monsieur le Curé to take care of all that I leave here. He will pay the costs of my trial out of it, as well as the burial of the woman who died today. The rest is for the poor." The sister tried to speak, but she could barely stutter a few inarticulate sounds. Yet she did manage to say, "Wouldn't Monsieur le Maire like to see the poor unfortunate woman one last time?" "No," he said. "They're after me. They would simply arrest me in her room, and that would upset her." He had barely finished his sentence when a loud noise was heard on the stairs. They heard the clamor of feet ascending, and the old caretaker say, in a voice as loud and piercing as he could make it, "My good man, I swear to God that no one has been in here the whole day or the whole evening. I haven't once left my door." A man replied, "But there's a light on in this room." They recognized the voice of Javert. The room was laid out so that the door hid a corner of the wall on the right when it opened. Jean Valjean blew out the candle and stood in this corner. Sister Simplice fell to her knees by the table. The door opened. Javert marched in. The whispering of several men could be heard, along with the protests of the caretaker in the corridor. The nun did not look up. She prayed. The candle was on the mantelpiece and gave only a very dim light. Javert noticed the sister and stopped in his tracks. You will recall that the very basis of Javert, his element, the air that he breathed, was veneration for any and all authority. He was absolutely consistent and could brook no objection, no exception. For him, naturally, ecclesiastical authority was the highest of all. He was religious, superficial and correct on this point as on all others. In his eyes, a priest was a mind that could never make a mistake. A nun was a creature that never commits a sin. They were souls inured to this world with a single door open to them, one that only ever opened to let truth out. As soon as he clapped eyes on the sister, his first impulse was to withdraw. Yet there was also another duty that held him in its grip and drove him imperiously in the opposite direction. His second impulse was to remain where he was and to hazard at least one question. It was the same Sister Simplice who had never lied in her life. Javert knew this, and venerated her especially because of it.
"Sister," he said, "are you alone in the room?"
There was a horrible moment when the poor caretaker felt her legs were about to buckle. The sister looked up and replied, "Yes."
"In that case," said Javert, "forgive me if I insist. It is my duty. You have not seen this evening a person, a man. He has escaped. We are looking for him. The man named Jean Valjean. You haven't seen him?"
The sister answered, "No." She lied. She lied twice in a row. One swipe after the next, without hesitation, speedily, like an old hand.
"Forgive me," said Javert, and he withdrew, bowing low.
"Oh, holy child, you are no longer of this world. Have not been for many years now. You have caught up with your virgin sisters and your angel brothers in the light. May these lies be chalked up to you in paradise." The sister's affirmation was so decisive for Javert that he did not even notice the oddness of the candles having just been blown out and smoking away on the table. An hour later, a man walking through the trees and the mists had swiftly put distance between himself and Montreuil-sur-Mer in the direction of Paris. The man was Jean Valjean. It has been established by the testimony of two or three drivers who passed him that he was carrying a bundle and that he was dressed in a smock. Where did he get the smock from? No one ever knew. But an old laborer had died a few days before at the factory infirmary, leaving only his smock. This was perhaps the one. One last word about Fantine. We each have a mother, the earth. Fantine was given back to this mother. The priest thought that he was doing the right thing in keeping as much of the money as possible for the poor out of what Jean Valjean had left. And maybe he was. After all, who was involved here? A convict and a prostitute. This is why he simplified Fantine's burial and reduced it to the bare necessity known as the Potter's Field. So Fantine was buried in this free corner of the cemetery that is open to everyone and no one, where the poor are lost without a trace. Happily, God knows where the soul is. They laid Fantine in the dark earth, among the first bones they stumbled across. She suffered the promiscuity of ashes. She was thrown in the common grave. Her final resting place was just like her bed. Part 2. Cosette. Book 1. Waterloo. What you meet with when you come from Nivelles. Last year, 1861, on a lovely morning in May, a wanderer, the man telling this tale, arrived from Nivelles heading for La Hulpe. He was on foot. He was following a broad paved roadway between two rows of trees, which undulated over hills that rolled along one after the other, lifting the road up and letting it fall, like enormous waves. He had gone past Lillois and Bois-Seigneur Isaac. In the west he could see the slate church tower of Braine-l'Alleud, which is in the shape of an upended vase. He had just left a wood behind him on a rise, and at a crossroad next to a worm-eaten signpost bearing the inscription "Former Tollgate No. 4, he came to a tavern with this sign hanging on the outside, "Aux Quatre Vents et Chabots, privately owned café." A bit farther down the road from this tavern, he reached the bottom of a small valley where water flows under an arch built into the embankment of the road. The cluster of trees, sparse but very green, that covers the valley on one side of the roadway, thins out into meadows on the other side before meandering off gracefully and haphazardly toward Braine-l'Alleud. At that point, by the roadside to the right, was an inn with a four-wheel cart outside the door, along with a great bundle of hop poles, a plough, a pile of dry brushwood near a quick-set hedge, some lime smoking in a square hole, and a ladder lying along an old shed with straw walls. A young girl was hoeing and pulling up weeds in a field where a big yellow poster, probably for some fairground show, fluttered and flapped in the wind. At the corner of the inn, next to a pond where a flotilla of ducks was sailing, a roughly cobbled pathway plunged into the scrub. This wanderer followed it in. After about 100 paces, having walked alongside a 15th-century wall surmounted by a sharp gable of contrasting bricks, he came to a great arched doorway made of stone, with a rectilinear impost in the heavy style of Louis XIV, and 2 flat medallions mounted on either side. A severe façade dominated this doorway. A wall perpendicular to the façade came right up to the door, almost touching it, and flanked it with an abrupt right angle. Over the meadow in front of the door lay 3 old harrows, through which all the flowers of May were growing pell-mell. The door was shut. It was held shut by a pair of decrepit double doors adorned with a rusty old knocker. The sun was lovely. The branches of the trees were shivering gently in that May way that seems to come from nests more than from the breeze. A brave little bird, probably in love, was singing its heart out in a great big tree. The wanderer bent down and peered at a rather large circular crater like the impact of a sphere in the stone to the left of the door near the bottom of the right-hand abutment. At that moment the door panels were folded back, and a peasant woman came out. She saw the wanderer and realized what he was looking at.
"That was a French cannonball that did that," she said. And she added, "What you can see there, higher up in the door, next to the nail, is the hole made by a Biscay musket. The ball didn't go through the wood."
"What's this place called?" the wanderer asked.
"Hougoumont," said the peasant woman.
The wanderer straightened up. He walked over to the hedge for a look at the view. On the horizon he could see a sort of grassy knoll through the trees, and on this grassy knoll something that, at that distance, looked like a lion. He was on the battlefield of Waterloo. Hougoumont. Hougoumont. This was the fatal spot. The first hurdle, the first resistance met with by that great lumberjack of Europe known as Napoleon. The first knot to go under the axe. It was a chateau. It is now nothing more than a farm. Hougoumont, for the antiquarian, is Hugoumont's. This manor was built by Hugo, sire of Sommerel, the same man who endowed the 6th chaplaincy in the Abbey of Villers. The wanderer pushed the door, elbowed his way past an old calash, and walked into the courtyard. The first thing that struck him in this yard was a 16th-century doorway that looks like an archway, everything having collapsed around it. Ruins often look monumental. In a wall next to the archway, another door with keystones dating from the days of Henri IV opens to allow a glimpse of trees in an orchard. Next to this door, a manure pit, some picks and shovels, a few carts, an old well with its flagstone and its iron pulley, a foal leaping about, a turkey fanning its tail, a chapel surmounted by a small bell tower, a pear tree in flower, espaliered against the wall of the chapel. That was the yard whose conquest was one of Napoleon's dreams. This patch of dirt would perhaps have brought him the world, if only he had been able to take it. Hens were scattering dust with their beaks. A growl was heard, the growl of a big dog baring its teeth, standing in for the English. The English were admirable here. The 4 companies of Cook's guards held their ground for 7 hours against the furious assault of an entire army. Hougoumont, as seen on the map in geometric plan, with its buildings and enclosure included, forms a sort of irregular rectangle with one of its corners cut off. It is at this corner that the southern gate stands, guarded by the wall that commands it at point-blank range. Hougoumont has 2 gates, the south gate, which is that of the chateau, and the north gate, that of the farm. Napoleon sent his brother Jérôme against Hougoumont. The divisions of Guiminot, Foy, and Bachelet pitted themselves against it. Practically the whole of Reille's corps was deployed there and crumbled, and Kellermann's cannonballs ran out along this heroic stretch of wall. It was too much for the Baudouin brigade to force Hougoumont to the north, and the Soye brigade could only make a hole in it to the south without taking it. The farm buildings bordered the yard to the south. A piece of the north gate, broken by the French, hangs where it has been fixed to the wall. It consists of four planks nailed to two cross pieces where the scars of battle can clearly be seen. The north gate, smashed by the French, and on which a patch has been stuck to replace the panel hanging from the wall, stands half open at the back of the yard. It is cut squarely into a wall, stone at the bottom, brick at the top, which closes the yard on the north side. It is a simple cart entrance, such as are found on all leasehold farms, two big swing doors made of rustic planks, beyond meadows. The battle over this entrance was furious. For a long time you could see all kinds of bloody handprints on the door pillar. It is here that Baudouin was killed. The storm of battle still lingers in this courtyard. The horror is visible there. The reversal of the fray has turned to stone. It lives, it dies, it was yesterday. The walls are in agony. Stones fall, breaches scream, holes are wounds. The buckled and shuddering trees are trying to get away. The courtyard in 1815 was more built up than it is today. Structures that have since been pulled down formed redans, corners, and sharp right angles. The English barricaded themselves in there. The French got in but could not maintain their position. Next to the chapel, a wing of the chateau, the sole remains of the manor of Hougoumont, stands crumbling. You might say disemboweled. The chateau served as a dungeon. The chapel served as a blockhouse. They exterminated people there. The French shot down with harquebuses on all sides, from behind the walls, from on top of the barns, from down in the cellars, through every casement window, through every basement window, through every loophole in the stones, brought kindling and set fire to walls and men. The volleys of shot were answered by conflagration. In the ruined wall, you can glimpse through windows garnished with iron bars the dismantled rooms of the main brick building. The English guards lay in ambush in these rooms. The spiral staircase, split from the ground floor right up to the roof, looks like the inside of a broken shell. The staircase has two sections. The English, besieged on the stairs and huddled on the steps at the top, cut away the lower steps, and these big slabs of bluestone form a heap in among the nettles. A dozen steps still cling to the wall. On the first of them, the image of a trident is chiseled. These inaccessible steps are still firmly attached to their sockets. All the rest looks like a toothless jawbone. Two old trees stand there. One is dead, the other is wounded in the foot, and grows young again every April. Since 1815, it has begun to grow through the staircase. They massacred one another in the chapel. The interior, calm again, is strange. Mass has not been said here since the carnage. Yet the altar remains, a rough wooden altar backing on a wall of rough-hewn stone. Four walls washed with lime, a door opposite the altar, two small arched windows, on the door a great wooden crucifix, above the crucifix a square window stuffed with a bale of hay. In a corner on the ground, an old glazed window frame, all broken. That is the chapel for you. Near the altar is nailed a wooden statue of St. Anne, dating from the 15th century. The head of baby Jesus was taken off by a Biscay musket. The French, managing to gain control of the chapel for a moment before being dislodged, set fire to it. The flames filled the place. It turned into an oven. The door burned, the floor burned. The wooden Christ did not burn. Fire lapped at his feet, which can now only be seen as blackened stumps. Then it stopped. A miracle, according to the people of these parts. The decapitated baby Jesus, though, was not as lucky as Christ. The walls are covered in writing. Near Christ's feet, this name can be read, Enquines. Then these others, Conde de Rio Mayor, Marques y Marquesa de Almagro, Habana. There are French names with exclamation marks, signs of rage. The wall was whitewashed again in 1849. The nations were trading insults on it. It is at the door of this chapel that a body was picked up, holding an axe in its hand. This cadaver was Sous-Lieutenant Legault. You come out of the chapel, and on the left you see a well. There are two in the courtyard. You ask, why isn't there a bucket and a pulley at this one? It is because water is no longer drawn from it. Why isn't water drawn from it anymore? Because it is full of skeletons. The last one to be pulled out of the water of this well was called Guillaume Vauquilson. He was a peasant who lived in Hougomont and was a gardener there. On June 18, 1815, his family took flight and hid in the woods. For several days and several nights, the forest surrounding the abbey of Villers harbored all the wretched scattered locals. Even today, certain recognizable vestiges, such as the old trunks of charred trees, mark the place where these poor bivouacs trembled in the depths of the scrub. Guillaume Vauquilson stayed in Hougomont to guard the castle, and hunkered down in a cellar. The English found him there. He was pulled out of his cubbyhole and given a good hiding with the flats of their swords before the enemy combatants forced the frightened man to wait on them. They were thirsty. Guillaume brought them something to drink. It was from this well that he drew the water. For many, it was the last mouthful of water they would ever drink. This well, where so many dead men drank, was also to die. After the fighting, one thing needed to be done in a hurry, and that was to bury the bodies. Death has its own way of harassing victory, sending pestilence hot on the heels of glory. Typhus is a footnote to triumph. The well was deep. It was turned into a tomb. 300 dead were thrown into it. Perhaps in too much haste. Were all of them actually dead? Legend says no. It seems that the night after the burial, feeble voices could be heard calling out from down in the well. The well stands alone in the middle of the courtyard. Three walls, half stone and half brick, folded like the leaves of a screen and simulating a square turret, surround it on three sides. The fourth side is open. This is where the water used to be drawn. The back wall has a sort of misshapen bullseye, perhaps a hole made by a shell. The turret had a roof of which all that remains are the beams. The iron supports for the right wall are in the form of a cross. If you bend over, your eye becomes lost in a deep brick cylinder filled with a densely layered darkness. All around the well, the bottom of the walls disappear in nettles. This well is not fronted by the broad blue flagstone that serves as an apron for all the wells of Belgium. The blue flagstone has been replaced here by a crossbar on which rest five or six deformed stumps of gnarled, stiffened wood that look like great big bones. There is no longer any bucket, any chain, any pulley, but there is still a stone basin that was used for wastewater. Rainwater collects in it, and from time to time a bird from the neighboring forests comes and drinks out of it and then flies off. One house among these ruins, the farmhouse, is still inhabited. The door of this house opens onto the courtyard. Next to a pretty Gothic keyhole plate, the door has a slanting iron handle in the shape of a clover leaf. The moment the Hanoverian lieutenant, Wilda, took hold of the handle to seek refuge inside the farmhouse, a French sapper chopped his hand off with an axe. The grandfather of the family that now occupies the house was the old gardener, Vauquilson, long since dead. A gray-haired woman will tell you, "I was there, I was 3 years old. They carted us off into the woods. I was in my mother's arms. You glued your ears to the ground to listen. I used to imitate the cannon. I'd go boom, boom." A courtyard door on the left, as we said, opens onto the orchard. The orchard is shocking. It is divided into three parts. You might also say three acts. The first part is a garden, the second is the orchard, and the third is a wood. These three parts are all enclosed on the entrance side by the buildings of the castle and the farm, on the left by a hedge, on the right by a wall, at the back by a wall. The wall on the right is made of brick. The back wall is made of stone. First you enter the garden. It is below street level, planted with currant bushes, overgrown with wild vegetation, closed off by a monumental terrace in stone slabs with balusters that have double bulbs. It was a seigneurial garden in the first French style that preceded Le Nôtre. Today, nothing but ruins and brambles. The pilasters are topped with globes that look like stone cannonballs. You can still count 43 balusters in place on their bases. The rest are lying in the grass. Almost all of them show scuff marks from musketry. One broken baluster stands on its shaft like a broken leg. It is in this garden, which is lower than the orchard, that six voltigeurs of the first light company, having broken through and not being able to get out again, were tracked down and taken like bears in a pit, and decided to stand and fight two Hanoverian companies, one of which was armed with rifles. The Hanoverians were ranged along the balustrade and fired from above. The light infantrymen, riposting from below, 6 against 200, intrepid, having only the currant bushes as cover, took 15 minutes to die. You mount a few steps and pass from the garden into what is properly called the orchard. Here, in these few square yards, 1,500 men fell in less than an hour. The wall seems ready to recommence the fighting. The 38 loopholes cut by the English at irregular heights are still there. In front of the 16th lie two English graves in granite. The loopholes are only in the south wall. The main attack came from there. This wall is hidden outside by a great quickset hedge. The French arrived, thinking they had only the hedge to tackle, leaped over it and found the wall, an obstructive hurdle and an ambush. The English guards entrenched behind it, 38 loopholes all firing at once. A storm of grapeshot and cannonballs, and Soye's brigade was smashed against it. That is how Waterloo kicked off. The orchard was taken, though. Since there were no ladders, the French used their fingernails to climb. They fought hand to hand beneath the trees. All this grass was sopping wet with blood. A battalion from Nassau, 700 men, was blasted to smithereens there. On the other side, the wall, against which Kellermann's two batteries trained their weapons, is bitten into by grapeshot. This orchard is as responsive as any other to the month of May. It has its buttercups and its daisies. The grass is high there. Cart horses graze there. Horsehair ropes on which clothes are drying are slung between the trees and make anyone passing by duck their heads. You can walk through this wasteland, and your feet sink in mole holes. In the middle of the grass, you notice an uprooted tree trunk, recumbent, covered in green shoots. Major Blackman leaned up against it to expire. Beneath a great tree nearby fell the German general Duplat. From a French family, who went into exile at the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. Right next to this, a diseased old apple tree leans, wrapped in a bandage of straw and clay. Nearly all the apple trees are falling down from old age. There is not one that does not have its cannonball or its Biscay musket ball. The skeletons of dead trees abound in this orchard. Crows fly among the branches, and at the back there is a wood full of violets. With Baudouin killed, Foy wounded, the fire, the massacre, the carnage, a stream made of English blood, German blood, and French blood furiously intermingled, a well crammed with cadavers, the Nassau regiment and the Brunswick regiment annihilated, Duplat killed, Blackman killed, the English guards mutilated, 20 French battalions out of the 40 of Ray's corps decimated, 3,000 men in this godforsaken hole of Hougoumont alone, run through with swords, torn to pieces, butchered, their throats cut, shot, burned to death. And all that, just so some peasant today can say to a traveller, "Monsieur, give me 3 francs, and if you like,
I'll tell you all about Waterloo.
June 18th, 1815. Let's go back in time. It's one of the prerogatives of the narrator. And put ourselves back in the year 1815, and even a bit before the period when the action narrated in the first part of the book begins. If it hadn't rained during the night of June 17th and 18th, 1815, the future of Europe would have been different. A few drops of water, more or less, brought Napoleon to his knees. So that Waterloo could be the end of Austerlitz, Providence needed only a bit of rain, and a cloud crossing the sky out of season was enough for a whole world to disintegrate. The Battle of Waterloo, and this gave Blücher time to get there, could not begin until 11:30. Why? Because the ground was too wet. They had to wait for it to firm up a little before the artillery could maneuver. Napoleon was an officer of the artillery, and he felt it. In his heart of hearts, this prodigious captain was the man who, in his report on Aboukir to the Directoire, had said, "This cannonball of ours killed 6 men. All his battle plans are for projectiles, to get the artillery to converge on a given point. That was the key to victory." He treated the strategy of the enemy general like a citadel and demolished it. He overwhelmed the weak point with grape shot. He set battles up and dissolved them with cannons. There was marksmanship in his genius. To hammer square formations, pulverize regiments, smash lines, grind and scatter massed formations, this was what it was all about for him. Strike, strike, strike without let-up. And he entrusted this task to the cannonball. A fearsome method, and one that, allied with genius, made this somber athlete of the pugilism of war invincible for 15 years. On June 18, 1815, he was counting more than ever on the artillery because he had the numbers in his favor. Wellington had only 159 pieces of ordnance. Napoleon had 240. Suppose the ground had been dry. The artillery could have rolled, the action would have begun at 6 in the morning. The battle would have been fought by 2 o'clock, 3 hours before the Prussian episode. How much is Napoleon to blame for the loss of the battle? Is the shipwreck imputable to the pilot? Was Napoleon's obvious physical decline coupled with a certain inner diminution by that stage? Had 20 years of war worn out the blade along with the sheath, the soul along with the body? Did the veteran make his inconvenient presence felt in the captain? In a word, was this genius, as many historians of note have thought, on the wane? Did he act so frenetically to disguise his enfeeblement from himself? Was he beginning to waver in bewilderment over a touch of adventure? Had he become oblivious to danger, which is a serious thing in a general? Within that class of material men we might call giants of action, is there an age at which genius becomes myopic? Old age has no hold on geniuses of the ideal. For the Dantes and the Michelangelos, to age is, on the contrary, to grow in stature. For the Hannibals and the Bonapartes, is it to shrink? Had Napoleon lost the feeling for victory? Had he got to the point where he could no longer make out the reef, no longer sniff out the trap, no longer see the crumbling edge of the abyss? Had he lost his scent for catastrophe? Was the man who once knew all the roads to triumph and pointed them out with a magisterial finger from the height of his chariot of lightning, now in such a sinister daze that he was leading his tumultuous team of legions to the brink? Had he, at the age of 46, been gripped by some supreme madness? Was this titanic driver of destiny now no more than a monster daredevil? We do not think so. His battle plan was, in the opinion of all, a masterpiece. To go straight to the center of the Allied line, make a hole in the enemy, cut him in two, push the British half to Al and the Prussian half to Tongres, turn Wellington and Blücher into two separate segments, take Mont-Saint-Jean, seize Brussels, chuck the Germans into the Rhine and the English into the sea. All that, for Napoleon, was involved in this battle. After that, we would see. It goes without saying that we are not claiming to do the history of Waterloo here. One of the scenes that gave rise to the drama we are relating is connected to this battle, but this history is not our subject. This history, moreover, has been told, and told in masterly fashion, both from Napoleon's point of view and from the opposite point of view, by a glittering array of historians. As for us, we'll leave the historians to it. We are just a distant witness, a traveller wandering through the plain, a seeker crouched over this ground moulded with human flesh, perhaps mistaking appearance for reality. We have no right to tackle head-on, in the name of science, a whole raft of facts in which there is no doubt something of the mirage. We have neither the military experience nor the skills and strategy that would authorize such a scheme. In our view, a chain of accidents governed the two captains at Waterloo. And when it comes to destiny, that mysterious defendant, we judge, as do the people, that guileless judge. A. Those who would like to get a clearer idea of the Battle of Waterloo have only to make the letter A on the ground in their mind. The left downstroke of the letter A is the road from Nivelles. The right downstroke is the road from Genappe. And the horizontal stroke is the sunken road from Ohain to Braine-l'Alleud. The apex of the A is Mont-Saint-Jean, and that is where Wellington is. The lower left-hand point is Hougoumont, and that is where Ray is with Jérôme Bonaparte. The lower right-hand point is La Belle Alliance, and that is where Napoleon is. A bit below the point where the horizontal stroke of the A meets and divides the right downstroke is La Haie Sainte. In the middle of this horizontal bar is the exact point where the last word of the battle was said. That is where they put the lion, an involuntary symbol of the supreme heroism of the Imperial Guard. The triangle, consisting of the apex of the A between the two downstrokes and the horizontal stroke, is the Mont-Saint-Jean plateau. The struggle for this plateau is what the whole battle revolved around. The wings of the two armies extended to right and left of the two roads, from Genappe and Nivelles, with d'Erlon facing Picton, and Ray facing Hill. Behind the tip of the A, behind the Mont-Saint-Jean plateau, is the forest of Soignes. As for the plain itself, imagine a vast, undulating terrain. Each fold dominates the next fold, and all the undulations rise toward Mont-Saint-Jean and end in the forest there. Two enemy troops on a battlefield are like two wrestlers in a headlock. Each tries to make the other slip. They clutch at anything to hand. A bush is a fulcrum. The corner of a wall is a shoulder brace. For want of some shack to lean against, a regiment loses its footing. Some shift in the plane, a movement of the terrain, a handy cross path, a wood, a ravine, can snag the heel of this colossus we call an army and prevent it from retreating. Anyone who quits the field is mown down. Hence, for the commander-in-chief, the necessity of examining the slightest tuft of vegetation and of digging into the slightest contour. The two generals had carefully studied the plain of Mont-Saint-Jean, known today as the Plain of Waterloo. Since the previous year, Wellington, in his clairvoyant wisdom, had examined it as a possible site for a great battle. On this terrain and for this duel, on June 18th, Wellington had the good side, Napoleon the bad, the English army being on top, the French army below. To sketch here Napoleon's appearance on horseback, his glasses in his hand, on the heights of Rossomme at dawn of June 18th, 1815, is almost too much. Before anyone pointed him out, everyone had spotted him. That calm profile, beneath the little hat of the College of Brienne, the green uniform, the white lapel hiding the insignia, the grey greatcoat hiding the epaulets, the diagonal slash of the red sash underneath the waistcoat, the leather pants, the white horse with its purple velvet cloth displaying crowned ends and eagles at the corners, the riding boots over silk stockings, the silver spurs, the Marengo sword, the whole figure of the last Caesar stands in everyone's imagination. Acclaimed by some, frowned upon by others. This figure has long been in blazing light, which has to do with a certain legendary fog that most heroes give off, and that always veils the truth for a more or less lengthy period of time, but today the real story has dawned with the light of day. This bright light, history, is pitiless. What is strange and divine about it is that, completely luminous as it is, and precisely because it is light, it often casts shadow where there used to be rays of sunlight. It makes two different phantoms of the same man, and one attacks the other and proves him false, and the darkness of the despot does battle with the dazzling splendor of the captain. This allows a truer measure in the final evaluation of the peoples of the world. Babylon sacked diminishes Alexander. Rome in chains diminishes Caesar. Jerusalem massacred diminishes Titus. Tyranny dogs the tyrant. It is a sorry thing for a man to leave behind him a pall that has his shape. The quid obscurum of battles. Everyone knows what happened in the first stage of the battle. A bad start, confusing, tentative, threatening for both armies, but more for the English than the French. It had rained all night. The ground had been pummeled by the downpour. Water had collected here and there in the hollows of the plain as though in basins. At certain points, the army's service equipage were in it up to the axles. The girths of the harnessed teams of horses were dripping with liquid mud. If the wheat and rye flattened by this throng of advancing carts had not filled the ruts and made a bed under the wheels, all movement, particularly in the little valleys next to Papelotte, would have been impossible. The business kicked off late. Napoleon, as we explained, was in the habit of holding all the artillery in his hand like a pistol, now aiming at this point, now at some other point of the battle, and he wanted to wait until the batteries could roll and move freely at a gallop. For that, the sun needed to come out and dry the ground. But the sun did not come out. This was no longer the meet at Austerlitz. When the first cannonball was launched, the English general, Colville, looked at his watch and noted that it was 11:35. The action kicked off with fury, more fury, perhaps, than the Emperor would have liked from the French wing at Hougoumont. At the same time, Napoleon attacked the center by hurling the Keogh Brigade at L'Haïssant, and Ney drove the right French wing against the left English wing that was bearing down on Papelotte. The attack on Hougoumont was partly a feint. To lure Wellington there, to get him to draw to the left, that was the plan. And the plan would have succeeded if the four companies of the English guards and the brave Belgians of Perponcher's division had not solidly held the position, and if Wellington, instead of massing troops there, had been able to limit himself to sending only four other companies of guards and one of Brunswick's battalions as reinforcement. The attack of the French right wing on Papelotte was a no-holds-barred one to overwhelm the English left, cut off the Brussels road, bar passage to any Prussians who might turn up, carry Mont-Saint-Jean, push Wellington back on Hougoumont, and from there to Braine-l'Alleud, from there to Arles, nothing could be neater. And apart from a few snags, the attack succeeded. Papelotte was taken. L'Haïssant was won. One noteworthy detail. In the English infantry, especially in Kempt's brigade, there were lots of new recruits. These young soldiers were valiant when confronted by our fearsome foot soldiers. In their inexperience, they stood up to the business fearlessly. They were especially useful as skirmishers. When a soldier becomes a skirmisher, to some extent left to his own devices, he becomes, to all intents and purposes, his own general. These recruits showed something of the inventiveness and fury of the French. This novice infantry had nerve, and Wellington did not like it one bit. After the capture of L'Haïssant, the battle wavered. During the day there was an obscure interval, from noon to four. The middle of the battle is almost hazy and is part of the somberness of the melee. Twilight gathers there. You can see vast fluctuations in this fog, a dizzying mirage, the military tackle of the day almost unknown today, flaming busbies, floating sabre-tashes,
leather crossbelts, grenade pouches, the dolmens of the hussars, red boots with hundreds of creases, heavy shakos festooned with torsades, the almost black infantry of Brunswick merged with the scarlet infantry of England, the English soldiers with great white circular rolls around the armholes for epaulettes, the Hanoverian light horse with their oblong leather helmets with copper bands and plumes of red horsehair, the Scots with their bare knees and tartan plaids, the great white gaiters of our grenadiers, tableau, not strategic lines, something for Salvator Rosa, not for Gribeauval. A certain amount of storminess is always mixed up in a battle. Quid obscurum, quid divinum. Every historian sees what he wants to see in this free-for-all. Whatever the combination of generals, the clash of the armed masses has unpredictable surges. In action, the plans of the two chiefs overlap and are distorted by each other. Some point on the battlefield devours more combatants than some other point. The way more or less spongy soils suck up the water you throw on them at different rates. You are forced to pour more soldiers there than you would like. Such expenditures make up the unforeseen. The battle line wiggles and snakes around like a thread. Trails of blood stream illogically. The fronts of the armies undulate. Regiments coming in or leaving form capes and gulfs. All these reefs are continually shifting in front of each other. Where the infantry was, the artillery arrives. Where the artillery was, the cavalry comes rushing in. Battalions are mere wisps of smoke. There was something there, but go and look, and it's gone. Clearings move around. Dark folds advance and retreat. A sort of sepulchral wind pushes, sucks back, swells, and disperses these tragic multitudes. What is a melee? An oscillation. The immobility of a mathematical plan expresses a minute, not a day. To paint a battle, we need those powerful painters whose brushes are dipped in chaos. Rembrandt would be better than van der Meulen. Van der Meulen was accurate at midday, but lies at 3 o'clock. Geometry deceives. Only the hurricane is true. This is what gives Folard the right to contradict Polybius. We might add that there is always a certain moment when the battle degenerates into combat, individualizes itself, and dissolves into innumerable detailed events that, to borrow the phrase from Napoleon himself, belong to the biography of the regiments rather than to the history of the army. In which case, the historian, obviously, has the right to simplify. He can only seize the main outlines of the struggle, and it is not given to any narrator, no matter how conscientious they may be, to absolutely fix the form of this horrible cloud we know as a battle. This, which is true of all great armed clashes, is particularly applicable to Waterloo. Yet that afternoon, at a certain moment, the battle took a definite shape. 4 o'clock in the afternoon. By about 4 o'clock, the situation for the English army was serious. The Prince of Orange commanded the centre, Hill the right wing, Picton the left wing. The Prince of Orange, frantic and fearless, yelled out to the Belgian Dutch, Nassau, Brunswick, never retreat. Hill, exhausted, was falling back on Wellington. Picton was dead, for the very same instant that the English had taken the colours of the 105th Regiment of the Line from the French had killed General Picton on the English side with a bullet through the head. The battle for Wellington had two pivotal points, Hougoumont and La Haie Sainte. Hougoumont was still holding steady, but was in flames. La Haie Sainte was taken. Of the German battalion defending it, only 42 men survived. All the officers, minus 5, were dead or taken. 3,000 combatants had been massacred in this barn. A sergeant of the English Guards, the foremost boxer of England, reputed by his comrades to be invulnerable, had been killed there by a little French drummer. Baring had been dislodged, Alten put to the sword. Several colours had been lost, one belonging to Alten's division,
and one from the Lunebourg battalion, carried by a prince of the Dupont family. The Scottish Greys no longer existed. Ponsonby's heavy dragoons had been cut to pieces. That valiant cavalry had folded under Brough's lancers and Travers' cuirassiers. Of their 1,200 horses, 600 remained. Of the 3 lieutenant colonels, 2 were on the ground. Hamilton was wounded, Mater killed. Ponsonby had fallen, stabbed 7 times with a lance. Gordon was dead, Marsh was dead. 2 divisions, the 5th and the 6th, were wiped out. With Hougoumont shaken, L'Haussant taken, all that remained was one knot, the centre. That particular knot still held. Wellington reinforced it. He called in Hill, who was at Merbrenne. He called in Chassé, who was in Braine-l'Alleud. The centre of the English army, somewhat concave, very dense and very compact, held a strong position. It occupied the plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean, with the village behind it and the slope in front of it, which at the time was pretty steep. It had its back to a strong stone house, which in those days was a property of the estate of Nivelles, and marked the intersection of the roads, a 16th-century pile so robust that the cannonballs ricocheted off it without making a dent. All around the plateau, the English had cut through the hedges here and there, made gun ports in the hawthorns, stuck the muzzle of a cannon between 2 branches, crenellated the bushes. Their artillery was waiting in ambush under the shrubbery. This Punic labour, incontestably authorized by war, which allows for traps, was so well performed that Oxo, sent by the Emperor at 9 o'clock in the morning to reconnoitre the enemy batteries, did not notice a thing, and returned to tell Napoleon that there was no obstacle apart from the 2 barricades barring the roads from Nivelles and Genappe. It was that time of year when the harvest is high. On the clearing of the plateau, a battalion of the Kempt Brigade, the 95th, armed with rifles, was lying hidden in the tall wheat. Thus assured and shored up, the centre of the Anglo-Dutch army was in a good spot. The danger of the position was the forest of Soignes, then right alongside the battlefield and cut off by the ponds of Frunendal and Boisfort. The only way an army could retreat into it would be by breaking up. The regiments would have been immediately disbanded. The artillery would have got lost in the swamp. Retreat, in the opinion of several military professionals, an opinion contested by others, it is true, would have meant a stampede. Wellington added to the centre one of Chassé's brigades taken from the right wing, and one of Vinca's brigades taken from the left wing, plus the Clinton division. To his English, to Halkett's regiments, to Mitchell's brigade, to Maitland's guards, he gave as supports and buttresses the infantry of Brunswick, the Nassau contingent, Kielmansegge's Hanoverians, and Omteda's Germans. That gave him 26 battalions at hand. The right wing, as Charras says, was pulled back behind the centre. An enormous battery was hidden by sacks of dirt at the spot that is today known as the Waterloo Museum. On top of this, Wellington had Somerset's horse guards, 1,400 horses, in a dip in the terrain. This was the other half of the English cavalry so justly celebrated. Ponsonby wiped out, Somerset remained. The battery, which would almost have been a redoubt had it been finished, was ranged behind a very low garden wall, hastily covered in sandbags and a large bank of earth. The work was not yet completed. There'd been no time to stockade it. Wellington, anxious but impassive, sat on his horse and stayed there the whole day in the same position, a bit farther along from an old Mont-Saint-Jean mill, which still exists, under an elm that an Englishman, an enthusiastic vandal, has since bought for 200 francs, sawn up and carted away. Wellington sat there, icily heroic. Cannon shot rained down. His aide-de-camp, Gordon, had just fallen by his side. Lord Hill, pointing a bursting shell out to him, said, "My lord, what are your instructions and what orders do you leave us if you get yourself killed?" "To do as I do," replied Wellington. To Clinton he said laconically, "Hold this spot to the last man." The day was clearly going badly. Wellington shouted to his old companions of Talavera,
Vittoria and Salamanca. Boys, don't even think of giving way. Think of old England. At around 4 o'clock, the English line moved backward. Suddenly, all you could see on the crest of the plateau was the artillery and the skirmishers. The rest had disappeared. The regiments, driven back by the French shells and musket balls, fell back into the valley, still crossed today by the access road to the Mont-Saint-Jean farm. A retrograde movement took place. The battlefront of the English slipped away. Wellington backed off. "Beginning of retreat!" shouted Napoleon. Napoleon, in a good mood. Though ill and uncomfortable in the saddle due to a painful medical condition, the emperor had never been in such a good mood as he was that day. Since morning he had smiled in all his impenetrability. On June 18, 1815, that deep soul, masked in marble, shone blindly. The man who had been so forlorn at Austerlitz was as gay as a lark at Waterloo. The greatest of the chosen ones misread things in this way. Our joys are shadows. The ultimate smile is God's alone. Ridet Caesar Pompeius flebit, as the legionaries of the Fulminatrix Legion used to say. Pompey this time did not have to weep, but it is certain that Caesar laughed. Since the previous night at 1 in the morning, Napoleon had been galloping around with Bertrand on horseback in the storm and the rain, exploring the hills around Rossomme, satisfied to see the long line of English fires lighting up the whole horizon from Frischemont to Braine-l'Alleud. It had seemed to him that destiny, with whom he had made a date on this field of Waterloo, was punctual. He had pulled up his horse and had remained sitting motionless for a few minutes, watching the lightning, listening to the thunder, and this fatalist had been heard to throw these mysterious words into the darkness. "We are agreed." Napoleon was wrong. They were no longer agreed. He had not taken a minute's sleep. Every moment of that night had been marked for him by joy. He had passed all along the entire line of the Grand Guards, stopping here and there to talk to the sentinels. At 2:30, near the Hougoumont Wood, he had heard the tread of a column on the move. For a moment he thought Wellington was falling back. He had said to Bertrand, "That's the English rear guard getting ready to decamp. I'll make prisoners out of the 6,000 Englishmen who have just arrived in Ostend." He chatted volubly. He had recovered the excitement of the disembarkation of March 1st, when he pointed out to the Grand Maréchal the enthusiastic peasants of the Juan Gulf, shouting, "There you go, Bertrand, here's some reinforcements already." The night of June 17th and 18th, he poked fun at Wellington. "That little British git needs to be taught a lesson," said Napoleon. The rain fell harder. It bucketed down. Thunder rolled as the emperor spoke. At 3:30 in the morning, he had shed one illusion. The officers sent out as reconnaissance had told him that the enemy was not making a single move. No one was stirring. Not one bivouac fire had been put out. The English army was sleeping. The silence was profound on the ground. The only sound was coming from the sky. At 4 o'clock, a peasant had been brought to him by the scouts. This peasant had served as a guide for an English cavalry brigade, probably Vivian's brigade, which was about to take a position in the village of Ohain, on the far left. At 5 o'clock, two Belgian deserters reported to him that they had just left their regiment and that the English army was expecting a battle. "Good for them," Napoleon had cried. "I'd rather roll over them than drive them back." In the morning, on the bank that forms a corner with the road at Planchenoit, he had stepped down into the mud. He had a kitchen table and a peasant's chair brought to him from the Rossomme farm, had sat down with a bale of straw for a rug, and had spread out on the table the map of the battlefield, saying to Soult, "Not a bad chessboard." As a result of all the rain in the night, the convoys of supply wagons got bogged down in the churned-up roads and had not been able to make it there by morning. The soldiers had not slept, were soaked to the bone,